Welcome to the 12th episode of the Mobile Storytelling Podcast with me, Wietse Vellinga, in Friesland.
And me, Björn Staschen, in Hamburg, Germany. This podcast is about how to tell a story with your smartphone.
This episode is a special one, the Christmas episode. And for this episode, we have a special guest. It's Mark Settle from the BBC. Welcome.
Yes, I'm not entirely sure why you would want me for your Christmas special, but I'm very glad to be here. Genuinely very glad. It's lovely to see you both.
Mark is a legend in the mobile storytelling world. Mark, why is that?
I have no idea, Bjorn. Why is that?
Well, you tell us.
That would be far too vain. I can't possibly say why I might be a legend in other people's eyes. It is surely for others to give their assessment of me. No, look, I mean, look, it's very nice that you say that. I really wouldn't agree. There are far better, grander, more worthy figures of such an accolade. But if you say that, look, I'm not going to disagree.
Because the reason why we ask it is because whenever I ask someone at the BBC, what does Mark Settle do? There is some debate on what you do. Can you explain what it is you actually do?
Yes. Is there not, first of all, a pause while they say, who?
No, you're well
known. And
then they
look through the BBC contacts. Okay, well, I suppose it depends who you're speaking to. I mean, clearly, if you're speaking to the Director General, then obviously he's bound to know who I am. But I think, you know, lower down, it begins to become less likely. Okay, so at the BBC, I work for something called the BBC Academy, which is the training arm of the BBC. So lots of people who have done things in their career, like edited national TV news programmes or presented radio programmes, after many years of doing hard work, they then come to the academy and share their knowledge to other people who want to improve their skill set. I somehow have got a job at the academy where I show journalists, as best as I can, how to use their smartphones for news gathering, for content creation, in sort of one of two ways, either the planned event where you know you're going to use it, or when something happens and it's the device you have on you. So my main role is to get people up to speed, because almost everyone at the BBC has a smartphone and almost all of those are iPhones. But the problem is the number who know how to use it well, the number who know how to use it to a broadcast standard, is still very, very small. I have this sort of mime that I do, not going to work so well on a podcast, but you'll see what it is. It's basically like an inverted triangle, where if you think right at the very top, you've got all the people who work at the BBC, then underneath it narrows down, and then you've got all the people who have a smartphone, then under that, you've got getting much more narrow, you've got all the people who've ever had the training in how to use it properly, and then right at the very bottom in the tiny peak are the people who do it regularly. And I'm trying to sort of make it into more of a square than a downward triangle.
How many people are at the bottom of that triangle?
I would say probably about a dozen, maybe 20 or so. But I do have to do a big, big caveat here, a big sort of explainer. The BBC is a very large organisation. Despite all the cutbacks that we've enjoyed or endured in the last few years, we still employ something around 19,000 to 20,000 people globally. There are many, many TV networks, about sort of 7 or 8 of those. There are national radio stations. There's the World Service. There are local radio stations. There are regional TV and regional radio stations. And there are hundreds, possibly thousands, of social media platforms. So when people say, how prevalent is mobile journalism across the BBC? You know, I'm not listening to Radio Scotland very often. I'm not listening to Radio Cornwall. I don't watch the television put out by the BBC in Northern Ireland. And no little alarm goes off that says, hey, this was done on a phone, such that I could say, okay, fantastic. That's another one to say someone has been doing that. You know, I know of people, some people who are doing it quite regularly, but there may well be people at Radio Scotland who are using their phone a lot. And of course, then you have the question of what counts? Is it doing the full workflow, filming, editing on the phone? Is it just getting a shot or two of video on the phone and integrating that into a package that has been filmed with a bigger broadcast camera? Is it doing a live stream into a radio program from the phone? So, you know, the definition of what counts as mobile journalism is also one of the factors that would dictate how many people it applies to.
What is your answer then? I mean, what is your goal? Do you want to make everyone kind of a full-fledged mobile journalist from filming to editing to live streaming to everything? Or are you happy if you have more and more people who from time to time film two or three scenes and, well, go on working with them in the edit suites?
I think it's much more the latter. I'd love it to be the former, but I think we've got to be realistic here. The BBC still has resources. The BBC still is able to deploy camera crews, radio cars, satellite trucks, getting people to outside studios. So when a story breaks or we are planning a story, where we can, we do deploy the resources that you would think the BBC is able to deploy, which means that my goal is much more to make people be aware of the capabilities of the phone when you need it. So, for example, if the radio car gets delayed or if the satellite truck that you want to feed your footage from is stuck in traffic or the camera crew don't get there in time, you've got your phone. Don't sort of say, well, I don't know what to do with it now. I've got a phone, but no, I'll just not film anything. So it's much more making people aware of how they can use it rather than having an expectation that they are going to use it. Equally, we're getting people understanding how it can be complementary. So despite what I've said about the resources of the BBC, there are still going to be occasions where, you know, we can't send two camera crews to one story for an interview. But if you use the iPhone as that second camera, so you have the main camera on your interviewee, getting it to look as good as you possibly can, and the iPhone getting the reverses, the noddies, the questions that then get cut in to the interview, then that is possibly a better use of resources than always deploying two cameras, which is just unrealistic unless it's a, you know, senior politician or member of the royal family.
But doesn't it make a lot of sense for like the BBC foreign correspondents? I know the correspondent for the BBC in the Netherlands, Anne Holligan, uses her phone a lot. Doesn't it make sense to especially point to these people to use mobile phones?
Yeah, and Anna is an absolute star. She really stands out with what she does and how regularly she does it. And whenever people ask me, give me some names of people who are regularly doing mobile journalism, Anna is one of the ones who always comes to mind. But she is different. She's a real self-starter. Not everyone is like that, unfortunately. Now, I hope I don't get in trouble for saying this, but I did notice a tweet from a BBC correspondent who complained about the fact that he wasn't able to go live because the satellite truck hadn't arrived in time for his slot on air. And I just held my head in my hands saying, you know, that really isn't the kind of attitude that we ought to have in 2020 heading towards 2021. That's not the kind of attitude that people ever ought to have when they've got a smartphone in their pocket. But unfortunately, too many people do not realize the capabilities. Whether that's a failing of my training, whether it's because we still give them the resources that help them do proper broadcasting or full-scale broadcasting, I don't know. But yes, the number of people who are like Anna, who are self-starters, who don't have a crew with them all the time, very, very small compared to the number who do have the resources and therefore perhaps become, shall we say, a little complacent that this is how it always is and how it always will be.
Would you say it is merely a question of too many resources, that there are not enough people in big corporations like the BBC using mobile journalism?
No, I wouldn't want to take away the quality that proper broadcast cameras, radio cars can give. Now, you know, you guys know more than anyone that the smartphone is capable of absolutely fantastic quality when people know how to use it properly. But equally, in the hands of a trained camera crew, you can get shots from a proper broadcast camera that you would never hope to be able to get from a smartphone. And so there will always be stories and places and scenarios where the big broadcast camera is going to have the edge by quite some distance over what the smartphone can do. But I think the mix needs to improve. There needs to be more people who know the capabilities of the phone, more people who know how it can rescue them, how it can complement using that big camera, which will then give better storytelling, better results to our audience.
I can imagine that the whole COVID situation might have changed that a little. I mean, going out in teams might have been a bit more troublesome in the last couple of months. Did you see any change in the attitude towards using a mobile phone?
There have been a couple of aspects about this, I think, worth saying. Firstly, a lot of journalists, I'm sure from the people you work with as well, actually haven't been going out a huge amount. They've been working from home. They've been doing Zoom interviews, which obviously moderately easy to do when you have a computer with you rather than having to go somewhere to interview someone. So we've been losing a lot of mojo in that respect. Equally, because of the demands of things like social distancing, one of the ironies of the whole pandemic is that it's actually to a degree made mobile journalism a little more expensive, a little more complicated, and a little more time-consuming. Because if you want to be distanced from someone, you need to either have a boom pole for your microphone or a microphone stand, and you know those are much bigger and much larger to carry with you, or you need some kind of wireless microphone equipment, and those can be several hundred pounds, several hundred euros, and then you've got all the extra time of putting all that together. So ironically, those who have been going out to do journalism need more equipment and more time, and it's more expensive than it would have been in the past. So I think from what I'm aware, there hasn't been quite so much. However, what it has done is it has allowed a lot of our journalists to get content from real people, where we've said to them, look, you know, we can't get to you for various reasons. Can you film something with your phones and get the content to us? So in that way, there's been quite a renaissance of mobile journalism. There have been a number of stories where, for example, in care homes, where for quite obvious reasons, we have been reluctant to go in, they have been reluctant to let us in, we have explained to care staff, look, here's your phone, film it landscape, please. These are a few shots we would like you to record and then send it to us. And then that has been integrated into our pieces. So in some respects, the pandemic has actually been quite productive in terms of mobile journalism.
So it changed not kind of in only one direction, but there have been pros and cons kind of for mobile journalism in the pandemic. You said it's not only resources, because you say you want to keep the cameras, but you say you want to see more people using mobile journalism, but you've been training it for, I don't know how many years, maybe more than 10, 20 years, long time. So what is the problem? I mean, why don't we all, you at the BBC, get more people to use it?
If I had that answer, I wouldn't be able to talk to you tonight because I would probably be busy training someone. I think there is still a certain reluctance. Believe it or not, there is still this sort of quality threshold argument. I know that's hard to believe because enough pieces have been done such that no one should have any doubts about the quality. Whether it's personal pride of, you know, why would I want to use this small device when I can get hold of a much larger device? But again, I do need to caveat this by saying there are quite probably bits of the BBC that are using their phones more than I am aware of. I know particularly in local radio, where it's one of the less well-resourced, shall we say, parts of the BBC, I know that their contributions, particularly in terms of audio, being local radio, are now almost entirely on phones. It's perhaps at what we call the network level, so the national TV programmes, the national radio programmes, where because these are the journalists at the top of their game, at the most senior level, they either have the producers who have the equipment or they have the resources deployed to them in terms of camera crews and radio cars that they don't need to use their smartphones that much. And unless and until they start to do it, then maybe others won't say, well, look, if this senior correspondent is doing it, then maybe I should as well.
Is it maybe a question of status? So if you are, if you've managed to become the political editor, whatever, I mean, you're finally entitled to your big radio car and everything. Why? Why give up the status?
It may well be partly that. Equally, though, having mentioned the political editor, so the political editor of the BBC, I know that on a number of occasions, certainly her producer very regularly uses the iPhone as the second camera because we can't always get a two-camera shoot, even for the kind of interviews that she does. So the producers, I think, are much more on board with this because they recognise that they can't get all the resources they want all the time. Whether the correspondents, the editors, we've got lots of like a medical editor and a health editor and a social affairs editor, you know, whether they all ever are going to do it themselves, that's a far bigger question.
Having said that, I mean, there's always, there needs to be someone that pushes them to trying new things. There has to be some innovator. How did you become that person? I mean, what got you in touch with this whole Mojo way of working?
I'd love to say that I am that innovator, but sadly, my status is not quite that elevated. I'm aware that there are people that I have connections with who have much senior titles and much more elevated positions. And one of them is actually starting a Mojo pilot in 2021, believe it or not, a Mojo pilot for parts of the BBC. And who knows, that may lead into something more constructive in certain parts of the BBC. But in terms of sort of my route into this, I was for many years a news reporter, presenter. I presented political programmes. I was a TV reporter, believe it or not, with a face like mine, or a radio reporter as well. And gradually, I thought after 15 years of being on the news treadmill, I thought it was my turn to get off that. And I sort of managed to get into the BBC Academy to do a course called The Future is Mobile. It was back in 2010. And that was getting people aware that the smartphone was going to dominate our lives in a way that it obviously does now. Back in 2010, people didn't have any ideas, but the projections were by 2014-15, 50-60% of people would have a smartphone and all of our content would be on it, not so much created with it, but consumed on it. And so it then sort of did a bit of a handbrake turn of, well, look, I've got the skills of being a journalist. I've got this lovely iPhone 4, as it was back in those days. Let's put the two together. And separate to that, but luckily at the same time, our developers who had previously made a clever internal BBC app to work on Symbian, if you remember your lovely Nokia N95. Of course, N95 these days is something else entirely, but then the N95 was the amazing smartphone. Would it be called a smartphone? Probably was, actually.
One of the best cameras ever on a smartphone.
Yeah, an amazing camera. It was astonishing for that long ago. Anyway, so they made this app called PNG, Portable News Gathering, on Symbian, but then they realized, hey, Symbian's not going to be the future. So they made it to work on iOS instead. And then they said, okay, well, we need someone who understands journalism and someone who understands mobile in a broader sense. And I put the two together, and then I've been doing this course.
You mentioned mobile also as a perspective on news consumption. I mean, more and more people consume their news on the mobile phone. Would you say venturing more into mobile production would help us journalists to understand more the way of people consume news now? Do you think the mobile phone as a means of production tells us a little bit about the consumer as well?
That would make a lot of sense. But again, there is still quite some gap between people who are aware enough of what their phone can do to make a piece on their phone that can then be consumed on a phone. There are not many people who do that full workflow. It still tends to be, if they do record on a phone, record it on the phone and then transfer it to their Mac or to their laptop and edit on that, or send it back using this app called PNG to let someone else edit on their Mac or their laptop. So yes, there is still quite a gap between what could be a much more productive workflow and what is happening right now. Obviously, of course, with the live element, there is much greater flow from the phone to output because it's much quicker and simpler to hook up over to hook up over Lucy Live, or we have a WMT app, which is for live streaming as well. And so that obviously is a little easier to get the from the phone straight out. But there is still, as I say, this gap between the number of people who potentially could do the workflow that you suggest and the number who are.
If we would learn a little more from how people consume news and transfer that into news production, we would possibly film more often vertically. You were a strict opponent of filming vertically. Are you still?
To coin a phrase, the landscape has changed, therefore my view about vertical has also changed. But yes, look, I can't deny that 8, 9, 10 years ago, the idea of filming vertically was not something that filled me with joy. It would be remiss, wrong of me, pig-headed of me, to say it's still wrong in 2020. There are still times when it isn't right, especially when you consider that my main focus is with BBC journalists whose output is primarily still traditional, almost may say legacy media, television, online, rather than social. So with that output in mind, landscape is clearly better suited. Equally, though, I'm not going to say now, look, never film portrait. But equally, because the BBC has so many outlets for the same content, you know, we've got TV, we've got online, we've got social, it's very rare that someone's going to go on a story where they're told, okay, this piece is only going on Instagram TV, therefore, please film it vertically. If that ever happens, then fine, that's a perfect use case. But it's much more productive for the many places that content has to go to, because it's a much more productive economic way of filming if you film landscape and then reversion it and you cut it square or you cut it portrait. And there are lots of clever tools inside the BBC that will do that automatically. There are apps on the phone that will do that for you as well. But if you filmed it vertically, yes, it will work very nicely on the vertical platform, but not so well on all the others.
You've mentioned the word apps. In the Mojo world, you're also a legend because you are probably the person that knows most apps, most about apps. And yet, if I hear you talking, I believe the BBC people you train tend to use the BBC's own apps. So PNG.
Yes and no, because PNG does have sort of a dual function. It can either be the app that you can film video in at 50 frames per second, where you can hear the audio. If you do any editing, it doesn't overwrite it. So it's, you know, very useful that way. Or it can be the satellite truck or the radio car to get content that has been filmed in other apps like Filmic Pro or Ferrite or Movie Pro or, you know, you name it. And then it just sends the content from that phone into the BBC's systems. So when I do my training, I flag up to people, look, here is our app. And if you're the kind of person who might not use your phone very often, or you haven't ever really been camera trained, this PNG app is going to do what you need it to do without overwhelming you. For those who do know one end of a camera from the other, or have used microphones and know how to use them properly, then there are much better apps than PNG. And PNG, as I mentioned, just becomes the way of getting the content from the phone into the newsroom. So when I show in training things like Filmic Pro and people who have had camera training, I was doing it yesterday, a couple of days ago, with people who are regularly using an FS7 and an FS5, they just looked at what Filmic Pro was able to do, and you could hear their jaws hitting the floor when they realized that they could take the skills they've got and use it on a phone now, and they won't be restricted to PNG. But for most people, where also there's the reluctance to spend the money because, you know, there is still that, believe it or not, PNG does enough, more than enough.
Yeah, you mentioned Filmic Pro, you mentioned Movie Pro and Ferrite. Can you name any other app that you says is absolutely essential for anyone who wants to get into Mojo?
Well, obviously, being at the BBC, I have to be moderately circumspect about saying these are the ones you really have to get, because clearly there are so many out there. And also it depends what output you're looking to create. Are you looking to film and then just send the video? Are you looking to film and edit the video and then send the video? Are you looking to film, edit, subtitle, grade, put a logo on, you know, literally everything, which is possible on the phone? And of course, there are some apps like LumaFusion where you can do almost everything you need to, but for a lot of people, it can be overwhelming because it can do quite so much. Or do you get a handful of apps that can each do something really very clever, and then you sort of mix and match, you do something called app bashing, where you do that with this app, and then that with that app, and then that with that app, and then you get the final output. So for example, there's a really clever app called Chartistic, where, believe it or not, it's free. It's a great way to create charts and maps and tables and graphs on your phone, because a lot of people don't have access, certainly outside of the BBC, won't have access to a full graphics team. And even if they do have access to a full graphics team, how... I've been talking too long and haven't had any water. Even if they do have full access to a graphics team, are they at the top of the queue to get the graphics done quickly enough? So Chartistic, you can make really clever graphics in that app. There are some amazing subtitling apps. Subtitling used to be one of the most time-consuming and expensive things to do on a phone, but there are some apps out there which are free that will do it amazingly. One called Vrew, V-R-E-W, only in about half a dozen languages. There's a one I came across or was told about only a couple of days ago called AI Subtitle, which does it in about 20 different languages, although sadly, Vitsa, not your native one.
Too bad. No Frisian.
Yeah, no Frisian, I'm afraid. So again, there are many, I'm looking at my phone here, there are many apps. It really depends what you want to create. You ask about video editing or video effects or text on video. I've got all my apps in folders. I think the challenge I sometimes find is that what I have is a thin knowledge of hundreds of apps. So if someone comes to me and says, is there an app that does X, Y, and Z? I probably say, yeah, there's this one. If they say to me, can you show me what it does? I say, yes. If they say to me, can you train me to use it to its full abilities? I then might say, can you come back to me in a couple of days once I've got my head across it? Because obviously all these apps change very often. I've got such a backlog of apps to catch up on. So I know that LumaFusion recently came out with version 2.4. I know it's version 2.4. I haven't yet watched the videos to see what it does differently to version 2.3. So when someone says to me, what's a really good video editing app? I will say LumaFusion. I can show them how to, put together a good package, but to do all the bells and whistles, my poor little brain doesn't have the capacity anymore to have everything about every app inside of it.
But is it really necessary? I mean, it is a bit of a hobby for you to have all these apps on your phone. If you started mobile journalism, would you say it is good to know as many apps as possible? Or would you say, come on, concentrate on these three, for example, or these four, and you'll kind of be able to do 95% of your work?
No, I agree. Find half a dozen, get very good at them, and probably you won't need all the others. But equally, part of my role is to be across the world of apps that exist, such that when people come to me and say, oh, look, is there an app that can do this? It does happen really quite often. Is there an app that can do this? I would say, okay, well, here's my suggestion. Undeniably, something like LumaFusion or something like Ferrite for audio editing probably does do the vast majority of things that people need to do. But if, for example, you want to do an audio waveform, well, I suppose with Ferrite you could screen record it, and then you've got sort of the little waves bouncing on the semicircle, or there are some particular apps that do audio waveforms, which go beyond what Ferrite is capable of doing.
Though only people will turn to you and go away happily that own an iPhone, right? If people come to you and want to know about the latest apps for Android, would you still say you're not the person to ask, or is that changing as well, as is your view to vertical video?
No, I mean it's not as bad as it used to be, but undeniably, because the BBC is, for good or evil, and I would say probably for good, iOS centric.
I would say for evil, but we know that.
We're going to agree to disagree here. But yes, keeping across the other side of the fence at the same time is even more of a challenge. I have a working knowledge of the apps to recommend, but quite the depth, certainly nowhere near as much. But equally, what I always say to people is, even if I don't know the answer to the question you're asking me, I know a man, and it is often a man. Also, there are some very good female mobile journalists out there, but to coin a phrase, I know a man who does. So I would recommend people to look at certain websites, to look at people's Twitter profiles, and they have that knowledge. So what I like to think of myself as is some kind of sort of central point of contact. So if you want to know something about an app or an accessory or a technique or where you might find a training resource, I would be able to give that information even if I can't give you that training myself.
I've seen on your Twitter that actually last week you did your first full Android workshop. Funnily enough, on the same day that Google crashed, YouTube crashed.
The two were connected. I'm sure they were connected.
Well, one would suggest that, maybe. But how did that go? I mean, what kind of a training is that if BBC is iPhone only?
Well, it was for a part of the BBC called News Round, which is designed for children of the age of, I don't know, 8 to 16 or so. And they wanted their journalists to be much more across how they can use their phones. And yeah, I said, okay, look, you know, I'm happy, in inverted commas, to do an Android version for you. But equally, these were journalists who already had a fair understanding of using broadcast cameras. So I needed to a degree, only get across to them what are the differences, what are the challenges, what are the things you need to be aware of when you do things with a phone, that if you already know how to use your broadcast camera, you already have the vast majority of the skills and the knowledge. You can translate that into using your phone, but there are going to be many things that are going to trip you up. So, you know, we go through all the things about, you know, low light may be something of a challenge, or a phone call. You know, your FS7 is not going to get a phone call while you're filming. They did not know that getting a phone call while filming with a smartphone is actually quite a problem. They didn't know how to solve that problem. So for them, it was much more the basics of getting your understanding of where the phone fits into the ecosystem of news gathering, rather than doing everything from the very basics about filming and, you know, crossing the line and wides and mediums and close-ups. There were a few sort of glitches. So, for example, because I have yet to find a way to get an Android device to talk to Zoom directly beyond getting the Android phone to dial in as a guest and then share the screen from that phone so the others can see it. But Zoom struggled when I was trying to show a camera at the same time. It was saying, oh, that's far too complicated. I can't live stream from the phone into Zoom at the same time as showing the camera on the phone. So that was quite glitchy. And of course, we had the ultimate problem, which I know you boys love, of the fragmentation. I only had three devices. Four, because of the Galaxy S7, the S8, the S10e, and of course, not a fourth Galaxy, but a Huawei P20. Which doesn't have a headphone socket, whereas the Galaxies do. The Galaxies do have expandable memory, whereas the Huawei doesn't. You know, some of them were USB-C, some of them were USB micro. You know, so there was much more, can your phone do this? Can your phone do that? And you know, it was that kind of challenge that I've tried to avoid strenuously. I mean, it's not like I haven't done any training on Android people. It's just this was my first ever solely, entirely only Android course. And who knows, there may be another one sometime in the next decade.
Well, you mentioned the headphone jack in this Android section. This might be something in the future why even the BBC might want to look at Android, because as rumors about the iPhone 13 have emerged, which will not only not have a headphone jack, but also won't have a charging port, which makes it fairly impossible to connect our microphones. What do you think about that?
Dramatic pause. I think, although it is going to be a problem if it comes out, It won't be a problem for quite a few years. This may come as a shock to you, but it's not as if everyone at the BBC gets issued the latest and greatest iPhone as soon as it comes out. A lot of people, up until very recently, were still using the iPhone 5S. There has been a bit of a recent program to replace those because we no longer support iOS 12 on those phones, which is as far as they can go for PNG. So these people are now getting their phones replaced with an iPhone SE, the 2020 version. So there will be quite a lag if the iPhone 13 is the phone that doesn't have any kind of port on it. But yes, you know, in 3 or 4 years' time, when eventually the iPhone 13 becomes, you know, the much more prevalent device that people use, then yes, you know, that is going to be quite a challenge. Whether we would go, I would be very surprised if we made a move towards Android, purely because on a much more corporate level than anything, the security that we get through iOS, where we have what's called a mobile device management system, where we can control, that sounds terrible, but where we can have some regard over a smartphone that is given to a member of staff. And if they lose it, we can take the apps away from it so no one else can use those apps. The understanding I have is that it's much harder to do that with Android. And also you have the fragmentation that when we are making PNG, 70 to 80% of the iPhones are using iOS 14, which means that they only have to develop the app to work on iOS 14, whereas with Android, it's much harder. I saw recently that, I saw only today that the Pixel 2, which came out in 2017, is no longer going to have any updates. Whereas the iPhone 5S, which came out in 2013, I think, has recently received an update to ensure that the COVID coronavirus tracing app works on it. So, you know, for security reasons, for the uniformity of the operating system, for the link between the phones and the MacBooks,
you know, Mark, people are using that's, to edit that's on. All, you know, that's all nice and good, but if there is no headphone, if there is no jack at all anymore, it'll be a disaster. I mean, because you will not be able to properly use it for mobile journalism. So if that really happens, there are two possibilities. One possibility is the BBC decides not to do mobile journalism anymore, but keep the iPhone as a company phone. Or the other way, you have to change. I mean, it's not that simple. If there is no jack, what about external microphones? Bluetooth?
No, because of the lag, and that's not going to be ideal. I mean, let's be honest, there may be some clever person listening to this or out there in the real world who might be able to make some kind of clever device that helps a phone without any kind of input to link up to the microphones and devices that we are all using right now. But again, I think the really important point here, firstly, as I mentioned, there's the time lag, that even if it's the iOS... Even if it's the iPhone 13, it may be the iPhone 14, there is still going to be quite some time before that becomes the prevalent device. And just because that doesn't have any ports doesn't make the iPhone 11 and 12, which do have ports, unusable. And the iPhone 12, which I don't have, is an absolutely amazing device. I think the capabilities of what the iPhone 13 and 14 are going to be able to do are not going to make the 11 and 12 no longer usable as smartphones. So I still think we have a good 5, 6, 7 years, maybe much longer, where the phones that people are using right now are still going to be absolutely fine. Because don't forget, I think each time the increase in quality you get from a phone is so incremental. Yes, if you push it to the absolute limits of filming in very low light or really challenging circumstances, or you do pixel peeping where you take a photo and then you zoom in at 600% and say, oh, look, that hair is slightly less defined than it is on the greatest and newest iPhone. I think for the vast majority of people, and we have to think about our audiences more than anything, for the vast majority of people, the iPhone 8, the iPhone 7 is still going to give them really, really good content and give them really, really good stories. So the iPhone 14 is not going to be a concern, I think, really, for quite some while.
And looking at the future in general on mobile journalism, what do you think? Where are we going? Are we continuing on the same path, or are we going to wearables? What does the future look like, according to you?
If I knew that, I'd be a much richer man and I wouldn't be doing a podcast with you guys right now. No,
Why
that's
not?
Very old. Well, I probably might.
Come on.
I, I know. So look, there are several different perspectives to take on this. The smartphone has become so central to our lives. 4.5 billion people around the world have got one. It's going to take quite some time for that device to be supplanted by something new. Clearly, though, there are far greater minds than mine, which is almost all of those 4.5 billion, who are thinking about what the next level stage is going to be. And whether it is going to be combining something in the glasses, which I'm doing a hand gesture to mine right now, even though this is a podcast, and something involving headphones or something involving a watch. Well, yes, but, you know, Apple are still rumoured to be coming out with their version of AR glasses at some point in 2021, 2022. I just think that the ubiquity of the phone is going to have at least another decade's worth. Yes, voice is going to be more and more important. There may be some kind of touch element where you're not actually touching anything real, but like a projection. It's almost like Minority Report. But yeah, I still think the phone for a good many years, perhaps towards the latter half of the decade, is still going to be the dominant device, particularly because, as I mentioned, the iPhone 11 or 12 or even the latest and greatest Samsung device doesn't suddenly become devoid of use simply because something else comes down the track.
How nice, Mark, because then we got at least another 10 years to wrap up our yearly season with you in our Christmas episode. So this was the 12th episode of the Mobile Storytelling Podcast. With me, Björn Staschen in Hamburg.
And me, Wietse Fellinga in Friesland. If you like what you hear, please share our podcast, and you can find us on all major platforms.
Thank you very much for listening. Merry Christmas and bye-bye.
Bye-bye and Merry Christmas.